Blog Talk Radio.
Your host for the next little while, Graham, Dale Graham. So sit back and relax a bit. Put your favorite beverage in hand. If it's morning, make that a double-double here in Canada or whatever else turns your crank. We're having an interesting discussion in the masonry now, and so I need to forward that. Continue that on and ask for more advice from you. The work is not stopping, nor will it. This isn't going to continue, regardless of the mechanics of the learnings. I'll call them that of our larger organizations that carry great responsibility. We are so dependent and so grateful for their efforts, their unwavering efforts, but in the work of the craftsman, you and me, I believe, is to make our grand lodges look good. So we need to, of course, always be ready as learners to improve our skills, to use our best judgments, and to look. Keep our organization and our fraternity in mind in all that we do. The collision of the fallout politically is what it is. It's never slowed the rate of progress in Freemasonry, and it never really can. But like any large organization, we don't always have the opportunity to create intimate conversation with all members of our order. So just like the people in lodges, different areas have different personalities, different needs, different geography, different history, and that makes as it should, it makes a difference. And we need to be able to allow that difference or acknowledge it for what it is. It's neither good nor bad. It's significant and it's important. So do the people in the north think the same as the people in the east or the south or the west? Well, let's say generally we have some things in common, but the way they go about their business and their work is that special diversification that's theirs alone. And we celebrate that every time we gather. I've just finished a gathering with really decent fellows over this past weekend, and it was an enormously rewarding event, and rewarding experience. I feel badly that I can't pursue all of the opportunities as I perhaps I once did. It's just the wear and tear. So common sense and reason has prevailed, has to. And I'm a better person for it. But I'm always thinking that, you know, there's so many interesting events going on. And I'm just I'm so, so pleased, as you can imagine, that there's this notion of the Masonic experience being enriched through education seems to be opening up. And it's remarkable. I'm so very, very happy about that. The results will make us stronger, will make us better, and will show to through history that there was a time when a group of men contemplated their moves. They weren't rash, careful, but they discovered an appetite for learning, a curiosity, and they set about their business filling that need. And I would say that we don't need to feed our egos and say, look at everything in terms of success, and he did this and I did that. We did this. There's no singularity in Freemasonry, I think. Nor should there be. I'm reminded of a really charming Mason, and some of you will have heard this story before. A fellow that would walk in and show his apron and talk about it being covered with more junk than entered apprentice. More junk, more things on it. More things that symbolically demonstrated his experiences with Freemasonry, or if you like to use the more popular term, the journey. Was demonstrated. It was like, do you know those badges and stickers and banners you used to collect when you were a boy, when you went on trips, and you'd stick them on your wall in your bedroom, and you'd always have that little banner of New Brunswick, or that banner of Prince of Rhode Island, or, and I'm just trying to think, or the Abbot, you know, going across on a ferry. You know. Those are things that were on my wall. It's little mementos, those little felt banners, and he was explaining this. The point of his apron, he was grandmaster that's recently left us left. I don't think I don't think he went through life expecting renown or feeling the need to leave deep marks wherever he went. This is a man that tread lightly, but when he talked, he was compelling. People would stop and listen to him, or I'd like to think that they should have stopped and listened to him, because he had something useful to say. And I think the wonderful thing about this fellow, the past grandmaster, is, in my mind, he epitomizes the grandmaster. Whatever comes in, after or before, he had that joie de vivre. He had that sense of scholastic ability. There was a respect for learning. And he was very charming about it. That meant he didn't have to go through life as if he was competing with everybody else around him, clamoring. He was part of something really quite interesting, and he let us see that in his actions and his decisions. So a little tip of the hat today to all those private conversations I was able to have over the years with Grandmaster Raymond Daniels. And his legacy is around me sitting here on this desk today. Anyway, face to face with masonry, or can you handle a little more of this? Are you into that contemplative frame of mind? Well, I've heard that there are people pulling this up off the airwaves and then passing it around, and I'm so very grateful. Thank you. This is what? We started this up in December of 2010. So, and thanks to you, thanks to the silent majority out there, this private kind of open but private kind of conversation has been going on and interrupted. It's always open because I don't reveal any secrets of the ritual. And I'm not at all ashamed of people listening in on the kind of conversation that we have. There's no embarrassment. This is us at our labors, us at our work. And sometimes we're a little cheesy, and sometimes we have our own language. But the experience, anybody that would say to be a good man, you have to be a Mason is foolish. And to say that the only way the principles of Freemasonry spread around the world is through testosterone-driven brains, well, that's foolish too. We're looking at a nobility of the human spirit. And I think you and I recognize that if you're at all a serious thinker, that something, the common narrative, that conversation around the world has been going on since the beginning of history. Remember, I was talking with a good friend the other day about what happened with the in the Middle East. She'd been working in Saudi and then in Qatar. And so, you know, over here in the hurly-burly, there's sometimes, there's no need, so I don't care kind of an attitude. I think about it if the media pushes it out there in front of me or during a soundbite, and then I can move on. Really, but I'm talking to the audience of Masonic Effects. Contemplative little rascals. I don't mean you pull over, you stop your car in the middle of the four-lane highway to contemplate the nature of being. Although I've pulled up behind a few people, I'm pretty sure that must be what they're up to. Al-Khwarizmi. 780 to 850 AD. He was the Caliph al-Ma'mun, founded the House of Wisdom. 832 AD. Now, what's brilliant about this was that he made it be known that he had a place and he was a community for the scholars of the world. He went about collecting a copy of every book that was printed at the time. And you know that would be manuscripts, wouldn't it? Hand-painted, hand-scribed. And this was just after Baghdad had been founded in 762. But the idea of that learned society, couldn't find anything older than this. As an outreach, you know, encouraging the mathematicians and the astrologers, astronomers, mm-hmm. the chemists, the poets, and novelists to come together, and yet it came and it evolved. And where is it today? So, my friend and I had that conversation about what happened to the greatness, or how is the Middle East progressing in their search to recapture And it's an interesting kind of a concept, isn't it? To recapture that level of greatness. And because some would say it's never really gone, but it's changed form. And others would say that period in history now has been transgressed by what? Economics? Rather than the sciences and the arts. This is a good time for me to give you a little taste. Just go and fill up your beverage to the brim. No, tastefully. Sit back. Have that conversation with me, and help me answer some of these questions. I'm going to try and put you in give you a little bit of what you deserve here in terms of some a way of relaxing and focusing your mind. This is the work of a fellow by the name of Chris Botti and the singer Paula Cole. Check it out.
What'll I do with just
You okay? You okay with that? Yeah, great way to get into the headspace, don't you think? I'm going to talk about some of the changes that have occurred in the world around us that are changing the way we think about Freemasonry. Oh my goodness. I was talking to a lovely fellow yesterday who's and about an initiative or an idea. And he, a younger guy than me, and he reminded me about the, you know, facing this attitude that we've never done it that way before. It's an old refrain. We don't do it that way. We do it this way. And I really am thinking that seems to be the effect of that kind of a statement is on our imagination. And so I'm going to talk again today about arts a little bit more, because it's like some of the discoveries of things that are right in front of us. It makes me great big secrets that are just pouring out of our history and pouring out of the symbols for anybody, any intelligent mind to see, to discover. Does it tell you the meaning, how this, what any of this should mean to you? How could it? The secret is what you discover. The journey of Masonry is a word that we use for experiences. Maybe a journey sounds a little more, you know, interesting and mysterious. But nevertheless, it is an experience. And we now have embraced this idea of the individual experience. It wasn't until 1835 that the term individual even was out there. Yeah, so you think that did it matter that for, you know, what, over 100 years after the governance process of Freemasonry developed, that this notion of the individual was not defined? Well, of course it does. Of course it makes a difference. Now there were different things that changed. There were things that led up to that process. So it's like Freemasonry. We can't just... Freemasonry is sort of an outcome and a process. So it's a dynamic. But what we witness over time in history are the outcomes of thinking and events and those periods of time. So always, I say unashamedly, the future is enriched because we're cumulative. We build on the greatness of the minds in the past. We need to talk about what's happened with the term success and celebrity. Have any of you noticed that the world is changing on its political axis? Any of you experienced that wobble? Yeah, we're spinning at, what, about 56,000 kilometers an hour? But we're wobbling a little bit. Oh, don't go don't go digging a hole in the ground and throwing your family in it with all kinds of fresh water and weaponized. It's not going to help. The wobble is that we're going through a correction, an attitudinal correction. What we were brought up in, the epoch of that period, the me generation, the I generation, the Generation X, the baby boomers, it's all in the blink of an eye. And now we're into another period where media is, the social media has done something to the way we connect with each other. It doesn't matter what Freemasonry does about that. It's happened around us. Now, what's distinct is that Freemasonry is learning to put that influence and that power, the power of the media, into harness so that it's beneficial to the order. Fantastic, isn't it? Absolutely. Here's what we have to say today about the commentary. Coming face to face with Freemasonry, is there anything about Freemasonry that is not compelling? Because if there is, I haven't found it yet. I have the sense for hundreds of years we have been scratching the surface. Just scratching the surface. Will you help me figure this out? I have this voice in my head telling me this is a great idea, and another voice telling me this is ridiculous. Drilling into the order will either validate or not what we know to this point. I wonder that the very work of exploration may be our greatest challenge. I don't know who said it, but I love it. In exploration, there needs to be people who have no rules. Can you think of something as daunting as the risk of ostracism by brethren? Operating without the rules, because the rules interfere with genius. At least you would have interesting company. The diaspora, avoiding conflict, resisting politics, seeking solitude. So let's collectively and more closely examine this enigma. Isn't defining Freemasonry as a 21st century enigma a bit audacious? Compressed into a form of secret signs and unique experience, it feels as if all answers but the right answer are trouble. The right answer? Well, that's as fluid as rain. Especially since we are so accepting. The fear factor will be to become enthusiastic about learning from failure. It won't be for the first time. No. Alchemists, brethren who were alchemists, we didn't own alchemy. Some alchemists were Freemasons. But alchemists paved that path for us, learning from failure. If we concern ourselves with the forces that formed Freemasonry, the compelling appetite for art, the need for science, for sure the optics are going to change. To my mind, a preoccupation with buildings and ghosts is done. We need to look at why we built it in the first place. The joke is Freemasons don't like change. Imagine that. We are change. Always the new tool, always the best design, always the greatest architecture. Always with a perspective on the commonness of mankind. Can you imagine saying that this is a group that doesn't like change? We were built on change. Just odd. Here, check this. This is Tom Waits' tune.
Where the smart man has been hung and the moon is in the street and the shadow boys are breaking out the wall. And you east of east the moon and the wind is making speech and the rain sounds like a rattle of a bell. And a pullion is weeping and a carnival saloon is invisible beyond season and the mirror. And the band is going home with the raining hammers and raining days. And it's true there's nothing left for the day. And it's time to change. And it's time.
And may the fiddler eye
Simone Kottmeyer. Beautiful, beautiful voice. Just fabulous, fabulous. So what do you think? The good and the bad of it all? Let's just scratch the surface a little bit. I mean, I do think it will be daunting and very, very interesting. That's where the answers are. All the good bits. But to help set up the sort of approach to this, or the common theme, it's like the prelude. You know, you're going to see a good ballet, or there's always a bit of music that sort of captures the musical themes that we're going to experience in the production. And you sit back, and it's like some of them are just, you know, just captivating. And when you listen to them after, it brings up whole storylines. Whole storylines that lead, of course, to that emotional climax, that conclusion that every great opera and ballet and symphony is expressing for us. Fabulous. But to do that, to get that prelude to our thinking, I'm going to rely on Thomas Aquinas. I know. What do? You try and find information. You know, I just keep going and searching, and then all of a sudden, boom, there it is. Here's the part that I want to apply to our thinking today. Aquinas claims that goodness and being are really the same. So according to Augustine, he says, things that exist are good. This claim is meant to express a basic metaphysical idea, namely that if something exists, then it necessarily has some degree of goodness. Augustine's argument for this claim is as follows. We can divide existing things into two categories, incorruptible things and corruptible things, with the latter, corruptible things, being inferior to the former, incorruptible. If something is incorruptible, then by definition it cannot be made worse. That is, it cannot lose whatever goodness it may have. Now, let's sing into our wheelhouse here. This is how I see Freemasonry. Incorruptible. The landmarks are incorruptible. On the other hand, if something is corruptible, then it can be made worse. Notice that a thing's being corruptible presupposes having goodness. Otherwise, it would not have any goodness to lose. While this argument may be sufficient to show that corruptible things necessarily have goodness, Augustine uses it to identify a problem with the view that something can exist even if it has no goodness at all. For if something has no goodness, then it cannot lose goodness, and therefore must be incorruptible. And since incorruptibility is better than corruptibility, it looks as if something lacking goodness is better than its corruptible counterpart, which has goodness. This is incoherent. What could be more monstrous than to maintain that by losing all its goodness, something can become better? Yet this is precisely the implication of claiming that something has no goodness whatsoever can exist. According to Augustine, the only remedy for this problem is to deny the existence of things that have no goodness. If something exists, then it must necessarily have goodness. Now, this is the build of the moral philosophy of Thomas Aquinas. 13th century. Yeah. That's just the prelude. Chewy little prelude. I want to talk to you about the effects of the pious. Be careful. Be careful. Just a little example through history. On the 6th of March in 1475, the mayor of the village of Caprezi near Arezzo, from a family that boasted its descent from the Counts of Conassa, had a boy. The father's name was Ludovico Buonarroti, and his son was Michelangelo. Michelangelo was born, and his father was took care to note that it showed how great the child would be and how noble a genius, for the planet Mercury with Venus in Secunda being received in the house of Jupiter with benign aspect promised that afterwards followed that the birth should be of a noble and high genius, able to succeed in every undertaking, but principally in those arts that delight the senses. The family moved to Florence. Michelangelo's mother died when he was 6. And the artist liked to note that his nurse was the daughter of a stone carver and the wife of a stone carver. He told Vasari, "If my brains are any good at all, it's because I was born in the pure air of your Arezzo countryside, just as with my mother's milk I sucked in the hammer and chisels I used for my statues." Buonarroti placed his other 4 sons with the wool and silk guilds, but he could afford to send Michelangelo to a grammar school. And there, the boy stole time from his studies to pursue his obsession with drawing, which his father and older brothers tried to cure by occasional beatings. Finally, abandoning hope of forcing the boy to give up drawing for some more elevated pursuit, Ludovico apprenticed him at the age of 14 to the painter Domenico Ghirlandaio. The precocious Michelangelo made copies of works by masters that were indistinguishable from the originals, then aged them with smoke and exchanged them for the originals that he coveted. After a year, he left the painter's workshop for a curious art school that Lorenzo the Magnificent had set up in the Medici Gardens. Now, there's a family you want to read about. Lorenzo had collected antique sculpture and employed a pupil of Donatello as a teacher. And he then hoped, by gathering young talents like Michelangelo, to establish a new school of painters and sculptors. Even as a boy, Michelangelo had sculpted masterly reliefs. His Madonna of the Stairs and the Battle of the Centaurs, magnificent. Discovering Michelangelo's rare talent in prime art, that was sculpture, Lorenzo added the boy to his own household. The Philistine Ludovico Buonarroti still found it hard to see the difference between a stonemason and a sculptor, and thought neither occupation suitable for a scion of the Counts of Conassa. Another Medici apprentice, the envious Torrigiano, left his mark on the face of Michelangelo. In one of their many ill-tempered encounters for which Torrigiano was banished from Florence, Torrigiano's fist broke Michelangelo's nose. When Lorenzo de' Medici died in 1492, the boy returned to live with his father, but, except for a brief interval, never ceased to be known as a Medici partisan in Florence's turbulent politics. While living with his father from 1492 to 94, Michelangelo often heard the eloquent Savonarola. This is a fellow between 1452 and 1498. Savonarola preached at the Cathedral of Florence. The passionate and persuasive Savonarola was the declared enemy of the arts that made Florence great and he mistrusted the ancient classics. The only good thing which we owe to Plato and Aristotle, Stevanorato preached, is that they brought forward many arguments which we can use against the heretics. Yet they and their philosophers are now in hell. An old woman knows more about the faith than Plato. Stevanorato drove the Medici from Florence in 1494 and established a, quote, democratic dictatorship with himself as head. There in the Piazza della Signore in 1497, he ignited his famous bonfire of the vanities, feeding it with carnival costumes and masks and wigs and cosmetics, mirrors, playing cards and musical instruments, every kind of work of art, along with volumes of corrupt, in quotes, Latin and Italian poets, including Boccaccio. When the Medici fled Florence, so did Michelangelo. First to Bologna, and then in 1496 to Rome, as the widest field for a man to show his genius in. And there he took some commissions, a Bacchus for a banker and a cardinal, and for a cardinal de Pietà, which was his first important work on the Christian themes that would consume his life and would become one of St. Peter's featured attractions. Meanwhile, in Florence, Savonarola, having exhausted the power of his eloquence, was tortured, hanged, and burned. When Michelangelo returned in 1501, the Republic of Florence commissioned him at age 26 to do the David that became a symbol of the city. And in 1504, to do a fresco in the Palazzo Vecchio opposite Leonardo's. This battle of Cassin, like Leonardo's battle piece, was never finished and never survived. When the ambitious and impetuous Julius II came to the papacy in 1503, he became the patron and catalyst of Renaissance art and a dominant force in Michelangelo's life. He brought Michelangelo back to Rome, commissioned him to design and build a tomb for him that would be the wonder of the world. Michelangelo remained in Rome until 1514, when the Medici Pope Leo X sent him back to Florence, where Leo X and still another Medici Pope, Clement VII, would set him at projects commemorating their family. In 1534, he left Florence for Rome, where projects for succeeding popes kept him occupied until his death in 1564. So the contrast between Leonardo and Michelangelo is an allegory of the arts in modern times. Leonardo left copious notes of his observations on nature and the world around him, but little about his feelings or his inner life. Michelangelo, in his letters, his poetry, in biographies by his friends and students, Vasari and Condivi, in conversation with Francesco de Holanda and others, left us vivid revelations and eloquent chronicles of himself. Leonardo, the self-styled disciple of experience, was a hero of the effort to recreate the world from the shapes and forms and sensations out there. But Michelangelo, prophet of the sovereign self, found mysterious resources within. These two greatest figures of Italian Renaissance art dramatized a modern movement from craftsman to artist. If Leonardo could be called the Aristotle, practical-minded organizer and surveyor of experience, Michelangelo would be the Plato, seeker, after the perfect idea. Michelangelo's major works were not merely assignments filled, but had an aura of the preternatural, of his uncanny ability to overcome all competitors. His most familiar early masterpiece, The David, in what he called the prime art of sculpture, revealed his ability to do what others could not. If other artists required a piece of marble especially suited to their design, Michelangelo could make a masterpiece from marble already mangled by others. Back in 1463, the authorities of the cathedral at Florence had acquired a 16-foot-high chunk of white marble to be carved into a figure to top an external buttress of Brunelleschi's dome. Two well-known sculptors, one from Siena and another from Florence, had already worked on the piece but had given up. The block was put in storage. 40 years later, the authorities still sought a sculptor. 1501, they decided to take a chance on the 26-year-old Michelangelo for the giant figure to be placed conspicuously at the door of the Palazzo della Signoria. Condiv, he tells the story. As they were not able to get anything out of this piece of marble likely to be any good, it seemed to Andrea da Monte at San Salvino that he might obtain the block, and he asked them to make a present of it. But the Opere, having disposed of it, sent for Michel Angelo and told him the wish and offer of Andrea. And having heard his opinion that he could get something good out of it, in the end, they offered it to him. Michel Angelo accepted it and extracted the above-mentioned statue without adding another piece at all, so exactly to size that the old surface of the outsides of the marble may be seen on the top of the head and in the base. He received 400 ducats for his work and finished it in about 18 months. In Florence, Michelangelo's work for those months became proverbial. How he measured and scrutinized the mangled piece to see what it would accommodate. How he made small wax models and parts for drawings. How he slept in his clothes to save time and finally released his fabled giant from material abandoned for half a century. This surprising achievement in sculpture would be outdone by his masterpiece in painting. Here, too, was the genius besting all others and even somehow exceeding himself. It's compelling. The pious aren't necessarily the friends of genius. This is just an example. Just an example. Somebody that has the talent to outdo all the other competitors. The craftsman transitioned into the artist made me think that of the thousands of men around me that are Freemasons, are we stifling the creativity of genius or near genius, you know? Somebody that can take ideas and form them at a higher level than anyone around him. I can only imagine that at the time there were people that were upset or critical of the work of Michelangelo. You see the work in a marble, wonder how can somebody express the human form so much more beautifully in stone that it seems transcendent. But he went deeper into himself to do it. The contemplation of Freemasonry, I think, presses on all of us to encourage that inward experience, or, if you like, the inward journey. Here's just a little something that you're going to like. just a little taste here. You've got to love the Masonic ideas, don't you? We get together, we'll talk about the enemies of Michelangelo as an example. Resist, if you can, the notion of the politics. Rise above it. There is a natural talent within Freemasonry to be celebrated. No need to lower yourself to when there's, although throwing mud on the walls is a lot of fun, it really detracts us, distracts us, embarrasses us, takes us away from our work and our purpose. We're better than that. I look forward to seeing you again, joining me. Thanks for the good time. Help me with some of this. You can see that I'm just a lost boy in the world of the Sonic Genius. See you again next time. Bye.